Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. More than 30 years ago, Washington, D.C. was rocked by a scandal known as the Iran-Contra Affair. It was a story that seemed right out of a thriller movie, and it raised profound questions about the United States' democracy and our role on the world stage. Today, there's another power shift underway in Washington. And with the transition to a new presidential administration, the nation is once again discussing the U.S.'s role in international affairs. With those conversations again in the public spotlight, we decided to re-air our series on the Iran-Contra Affair. We hope you enjoy it. It's early November 1986. A magazine reporter sits in his office in Washington, D.C. He's supposed to be grinding out a deadline, but he's having a hard time concentrating. The D.C. rumor mill is firing on all cylinders, and the office is abuzz. A few days ago, Al-Shara, a Lebanese periodical, broke the political story of the decade. Senior U.S. government officials, including former National Security Advisor Robert Bud McFarlane and Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, made a secret trip to Iran to trade arms for hostages. The story was confirmed by the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament. So far, though, it's been radio silence at the White House. They have neither confirmed nor denied the story. For reporters all across Washington, it's a frantic race for the truth. But this reporter is about to snatch a big scoop.
Yeah, hello?
You got a minute?
Immediately, the reporter knows who's on the other end of the line. He'd recognize that voice anywhere. And he knows this particular man doesn't call journalists unless he has something to say.
Are you alone?
Hang on a sec.
He quickly closes the door to his office.
Are we on record?
No. I'll talk on background.
All right. Who do I say you are?
An anonymous source close to the White House.
Anonymous it is. What do you got?
This Iran ordeal? There's more to the story.
I'm listening.
First of all, this was not the president's doing.
The reporter nearly spits out his coffee.
A delegation of top White House officials go on a secret mission to Iran, and the president doesn't even know about it? Come on.
Look, the president wants the hostages back, period. But that's not the issue. The issue is, who's behind the operation? Everyone is looking at the Oval Office for answers, but they're looking in the wrong place.
All right, where should they be looking?
The National Security Council.
But the NSC answers to the president.
Not this time. At least not directly.
So who's pulling the strings?
Bud McFarlane.
The reporter grabs a pen and paper and starts furiously scribbling notes.
Is that why Bud resigned? Did Reagan force him out?
Here is all I'm willing to say. Iran is a rogue NSC operation. Bud was way off the reservation on this. Reagan didn't know about it because Bud never told him. I give you enough to go on?
Yeah. I'll call if I need anything else.
Don't. This conversation never happened.
On November 6, 1987, Reagan tells reporters that the Al-Shara story has no foundation. Beyond that, his cabinet is divided on how to respond. Some favor Reagan telling the American people the truth. Others favor Reagan saying something, but not everything. While still others favor silence, believing the best comment is no comment at all. But Don Regan doesn't wait for a consensus. Don takes matters into his own hands. He talks to multiple reporters. He fingers Bud as the central culprit, the mastermind behind the Iran operation. Don tries to plant a story, but it never gets published. That's because reporters start calling the White House, asking officials to comment on Bud's role in the scandal, and a coworker tips Bud off. Bud is furious. This isn't the first time Don Regan has tried to besmirch his character, and it certainly isn't the first time Bud has faced a tough fight. Bud is a soldier, a former Marine. He responds to Don's treachery by doing what a soldier does best. He fights back. American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, the story of a murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. When it comes to American political scandals, it's not always the scandal itself that gets people in the most trouble. It's often the steps they take to cover it up. In the days after the Arms for Hostages story breaks in Al-Sharaa, there's a mad scramble in the White House to construct a narrative. Whoever can tell the most compelling story and get the public to believe it would, in a sense, be writing the first draft of history and deciding who takes the fall. Two men in President Reagan's orbit set out to do just that, Chief of Staff Don Regan and someone who has so far only been tangentially involved, but will soon play a large role in the attempt to cover up Iran-Contra, Attorney General Ed Meese. This is Episode 3, Don and Ed. It's November 8, 1986. National Security Advisor John Poindexter and Chief of Staff Don Regan meet for breakfast in Washington, D.C. This is not a social outing. It's strictly business, and the mood is tense. Poindexter looks Don right in the eye.
Don, we need to talk. Let's talk, then. It's about Bud.
Don knows exactly where this conversation is headed. When Don fingered Bud to the press, he knew there was a chance Bud would find out. But it was a risk worth taking. Don's not blaming Bud to be cruel, though there's certainly no love lost between them. Don is trying to protect the president.
Bud is angry, Don. He sent me this.
It's a copy of a private message sent to Poindexter from Bud McFarlane. When Bud resigned in late 1985, Don was happy to see him go. But Don knows full well Bud never really left the White House. He keeps a secure line to Poindexter and Ollie North through his NSC computer and stays in close communication with them both.
Read it. I don't need to read it, John. I know what it says. Don, read it.
Don begrudgingly picks up the piece of paper and scans the document. One sentence sticks out in particular. Bud writes, "This will be the second lie Don Regan has sown against my character, and I won't stand for it."
He's threatening to sue you for singling him out. Be smart, Don. We need Bud on our side. I need to know you're going to back off.
But backing off is not what Don does. He's a scrapper. He grew up poor in the Irish section of Boston, but he pulled himself up by his bootstraps. A year after the outbreak of World War II, he dropped out of Harvard Law School to join the Marine Corps. After the war, Don took a job at Merrill Lynch. He worked his way up to the top, becoming Merrill's chairman and CEO before going to work in government. Don didn't make it to the top by backing down from a fight, but he knows Poindexter has a point. Blaming Bud might protect the president, but Bud could hurt him too. He could hurt all of them, because Bud knows everything about Iran-Contra. So Don reluctantly agrees.
All right, John, I'll back off. Thank you, Don.
There are records proving this breakfast meeting happened, but not exactly what was said in the conversation. But there are records of a private message Poindexter sent to Bud right after the breakfast. The message is short and to the point. Don will keep his mouth shut. On the morning of November 10th, Reagan and his top advisors gather at the White House. The Al Shaarah story has been public knowledge for a week, and the press is demanding answers. The question is, how will Reagan respond? Most of Reagan's advisors want the president to stay silent, but his chief of staff, Don Regan, sees it differently. Reagan is getting murdered in the press, and Don wants Reagan to be proactive. In the meeting, Don implores the president, "We must get a statement out now. We are being attacked and we are being hurt." Reagan agrees. "We must say something," he says, and then adds a caveat, "but not much." For one thing, the hostages are still in the hands of terrorists, and any statement might provoke their captors to violence. For another thing, if Reagan is too forthcoming, he might provoke Congress into taking action against him. National Security Advisor John Poindexter has a solution to Reagan's dilemma. He lays out a narrative for the room, a false narrative. The Iran operation was never about arms for hostages, he proposes. It was about re-engaging Iran and establishing contact with moderate elements inside the country. And it only started after Reagan signed a formal finding in January 1986. Anything that happened before was all Israel's doing. But Don thinks this approach makes the president vulnerable. Don wants to protect the president, and in order to do that, he believes that eventually someone's head will have to roll. Someone's other than the president's. From Don's perspective, Poindexter's narrative is not protecting the president. It's putting him in harm's way. But Don also knows it's not his decision to make. In the end, this decision, like all decisions, belongs to President Reagan. Ultimately, Reagan accepts Poindexter's false narrative. But before Reagan tells the story to the American people, he'll have to tell it to Congress. In mid-November 1985, members of the press aren't the only ones demanding answers about the Iran arms deal. Since the Al Shaarah story broke, Congress has been putting pressure on the White House to make a disclosure about what really happened. In response, Reagan decides to meet Congress head-on. On November 12th, at 2 o'clock p.m., 9 days after the Al Shaarah story breaks, Reagan and his top advisors hold a closed-door meeting with key members of Congress in the Situation Room. There are some big congressional players present: Senate Minority Leader Robert Byrd, future presidential candidate Bob Dole, and a no-nonsense congressman from Wyoming, House Representative Dick Cheney. Dole and Cheney are Republicans, and they're big supporters of Ronald Reagan. But today, they're here to ask tough questions about the Iran arms deal. Questions like, did the United States trade arms for hostages? And if so, who knew what, when? Poindexter leads off the meeting and lays out the false narrative. The Iran operation was about re-engaging Iran and establishing contact with moderate elements inside the country. It was never about arms for hostages. Right off the bat, Senator Byrd asks a tough question. When did we first make contact with Iran? Poindexter answers, the process began in November 1985. But Poindexter claims no transfer of material had taken place until Reagan signed the finding in January 86. Poindexter does not tell the congressman about the November 1985 Hawk mission, or the finding Reagan signed after the fact, the finding that was never delivered to Congress. Poindexter, seated at a table in the White House with some of the most powerful men in the country, lies. Poindexter is not the only one bending the truth in the meeting. Reagan tells the congressman that the Iran initiative was principally a covert intelligence operation that involved no negotiations with terrorists. Its purpose was to enhance America's position in the Middle East. Don Regan doesn't say much in the meeting, but he has to be frustrated. His goal is to protect President Reagan, and Reagan just played fast and loose with the truth to Congress, which makes his job of protecting the president all that much harder. After the meeting, Reagan is frustrated. The congressmen are skeptical. The media is still in a frenzy, and the target is still squarely on Reagan's back. Right after the meeting, Secretary of State George Shultz pulls Don Regan aside. He tells Don the same thing he's been saying since the Al Shaarah story first broke. Reagan is in serious trouble. He urges Don, the president must come forward and tell the truth. It's the only way to get the people on his side and to get Congress off his back. Don calms Shultz down. The president has made his decision about what he wants to say about the Iran deal. It's important now that everyone stays on the same page and sticks to the company line. Don asked Shultz to make the rounds on the Sunday talk shows to get the word out. President Reagan did not trade arms for hostages. That's been his policy, and that will always be his policy. Shultz agrees, but deep down, he's very worried. A few days back, in a closed-door meeting between Reagan and his advisors, Shultz was the lone man advocating that Reagan go public with the whole truth. When Poindexter's false narrative was floated in the meeting, Shultz was incredulous. He asked the room, "How can you say the hostages and the missile shipments aren't linked?" Reagan fired back, "It's not linked." Shultz left the meeting early. He stormed back to the State Department. One of his aides asked if everything was all right, and Shultz exploded. He railed against Reagan's advisors. "They're distorting the record. They're trying to get the president to lie. They're dragging him down a drain. It's Watergate all over again." Shultz isn't the only one worried that Iran-Contra could be another Watergate. In his diary on the same day as the meeting with Congress, President Reagan writes, "The press looks like it's trying to create another Watergate. I want to go public and tell the people the truth. We are trying to arrange it for tomorrow." The next day, on November 13th, 10 days after the Al Sharaa story broke, Reagan addresses the nation from the Oval Office. But what he gives them isn't exactly the truth.
"Good evening. I know you've been reading, seeing, and hearing a lot of stories the past several days attributed to Danish sailors, unnamed observers at Italian ports and Spanish harbors, and especially unnamed government officials of my administration. As Will Rogers once said, rumor travels faster, but it don't stay put as long as truth. So let's get to the facts. The charge has been made that the United States has shipped weapons to Iran as ransom payment for the release of American hostages in Lebanon, that the United States undercut its allies and secretly violated American policy against trafficking with terrorists. Those charges are utterly false. The United States has not made concessions to those who hold our people captive in Lebanon, and we will not. The United States has not swapped boatloads of plane loads of American weapons for the return of American hostages, and we will not. As president, I've always operated on the belief that, given the facts, the American people will make the right decision. I believe that to be true now. Thank you, and God bless you."
The public doesn't buy it. After his address, President Reagan's popularity starts to plummet. Polls show that for every American who accepts Reagan's version of events, six more doubt him. They believe Reagan's administration traded arms for hostages, that Reagan knew about the operation, and he authorized it. But still, he denied it over and over again. On November 12th, he denied it to Congress in the Situation Room. On November 13th, he denied it to the American people in his Oval Office address. But after that address, there are numerous leaks from the White House, and the false narrative starts to unravel. The same day as Reagan's televised remarks, reporters put the screws to Poindexter. He caves under the pressure. Poindexter admits that a small amount of weapons had gone to Iran in connection with the first release of a hostage. This is a major problem for the president. Poindexter's confession confirms on the record that Reagan was not telling the whole truth, not to Congress and not to the American people. But in a press conference on November 19th, Reagan doubles down.
"Mr. President, you have stated flatly, and you stated flatly again tonight, that you did not trade weapons for hostages. And yet, the record shows that every time an American hostage was released, last September, this July, and again just this very month, there had been a major shipment of arms just before that. Are we all to believe that was just a coincidence?"
"Chris, the only thing I know about major shipments of arms, as I've said, everything that we sold them could be put in one cargo plane and there would be plenty of room left over."
"Sir, if I may, the polls show that a lot of American people just simply don't believe you. That the one thing that you've had going for you more than anything else in your presidency, your credibility, has been severely damaged. Can you repair it? What does it mean for the rest of your presidency?"
"Well, I imagine I'm the only one around who wants to repair it, and I didn't have anything to do with damaging it."
Reagan's words might be true to him, but Don Regan, who is watching in the wings, knows they're not true to the facts. With every statement he makes, Reagan digs the hole deeper and edges closer to the precipice of danger. Don wants to get the press and the American people and by extension, Congress, off the president's back. Don knows for that to happen, someone will have to take the fall. And in order for that to happen, everyone in the White House will have to speak with a unified voice. But in order to craft a convincing narrative, you have to start from a baseline of truth. No more contradictions, no more slips. President Reagan is having a difficult time with that concept. Don is starting to understand that the protection President Reagan needs is not protection from his political enemies or his detractors in the media. Reagan needs protection from himself. American Scandal is sponsored by BetterHelp. I'm an introvert when there's not a microphone in front of me. People drain me. Even the smallest interactions, like ordering a pizza or calling a plumber, are taxing. And I know I avoid socializing sometimes because it's just so tiresome. But it's also delightful, a connection I crave, and that's a conundrum I'm still working on. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And as the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless search for a therapist. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/AS today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/AS. American Scandal is sponsored by the new masterpiece series, Mr. Bates vs. the Post Office. Following one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in British legal history, the new masterpiece series, Mr. Bates vs. the Post Office, is based on the shocking true story of the British Post Office scandal. When money started to seemingly disappear from local branches, the government-owned post office wrongly blamed their own managers for its apparent loss. And for more than a decade, hundreds were accused of theft and fraud. Many were even sent to prison, leaving lives, marriages, and reputations in ruins. But the issue was actually caused by errors in the post office's own computer system, something it denied for years. Don't miss Mr. Bates vs. the Post Office, starring Toby Jones, beginning Sunday, April 7th on Masterpiece on PBS. The series will be available to stream on the PBS app, PBS Masterpiece Prime Video Channel, and PBS.org. Don Regan's desire to protect President Reagan goes beyond the call of duty. For one thing, Don likes the president, and the feeling is mutual. Don has a reputation for being rough around the edges. He doesn't have a lot of friends in politics, but he and Reagan are definitely kindred spirits. Secondly, there's something else that might be driving Don, a feeling of personal responsibility. Don once boasted that not even a sparrow could fly through the White House without his hearing about it. He has a tight lid on everything. And yet, this Iran-Contra scandal is unraveling on his watch, and his friend, President Reagan, is in the line of fire. On November 20th, 17 days after the Al-Sharaa story breaks, Don Regan and Secretary of State George Shultz meet with President Reagan in the family quarters of the White House. For 45 minutes, Shultz tries desperately to get Reagan to face the truth. He did trade arms for hostages, but Reagan doesn't see it. He contends that because he never intended to trade arms for hostages, he had never done so. Shultz reminds the president that Bud McFarland had told him about the 1985 Hawk shipment. Reagan responds, "Oh, I knew about that, but that wasn't arms for hostages." Shultz is gobsmacked. He later tells an aide, "We didn't shake him one bit. He refuses to see we have a problem." Reagan is blind to his own potential culpability. But there is someone else who fully understands the gravity of the situation, Reagan's Attorney General, Ed Meese. At first glance, Ed Meese doesn't look like much. He has droopy skin and permanent bags under his exhausted-looking eyes. But Ed is a smart, calculating man, a fastidious man, known for taking copious, detailed notes. And like most around him in the administration, he is fiercely loyal to Ronald Reagan. Ed has been following the Iran story closely. And like Don, he's worried about the president's public statements. He's worried Reagan is backing himself into a corner he cannot get out of. On the morning of November 21st, 18 days after the Al-Sharaa story breaks, Ed decides to take matters into his own hands. He gathers his top deputies in his office in D.C. and lays out his plan. Ed tells his staff he is going to convince President Reagan that a fact-finding mission is needed, an internal investigation to find out the answer to the question everyone is asking about the Iran deal. Who knew what and when? The Iran deal is a National Security Council operation, so before Ed goes to the president, he calls the head of the NSC, National Security Advisor John Poindexter. It's bright and early on Friday, November 21st, 1986. National Security Advisor Poindexter sits at his desk, poring over a large stack of memos.
This is Poindexter.
John, it's Ed.
Poindexter isn't surprised to get a call from Attorney General Ed Meese. He and Meese have been in constant contact throughout the month of November. The Iran arms scandal is a major crisis, and it's all hands on deck.
What can I do for you?
Listen, there's a disagreement in the cabinet about what happened in November 85 with the Hawk shipment.
I've told you everything I know.
I know you have. I'm meeting with the president at the White House at 11:30. We're going to talk through the timeline with the cabinet to try and sort out the disagreement. I'd like you to be there.
Of course.
I don't think I have to tell you how important this November Hawk situation is. If the president knew about it in advance...
Yes, I know.
Well, we just need to get this thing cleared up to make sure we're all on the same page.
Absolutely.
One other thing, John.
Yes?
I'm going to be sending over a few of my people this afternoon to help me piece the puzzle together. I was hoping you might pull some documents for my guys.
What documents?
Just anything pertinent, anything material. Can I count on you?
Of course, Ed. You have my full cooperation.
Great. I'll see you at the meeting.
When Poindexter hangs up the phone, he knows what he has to do. Poindexter has the CIA finding from the November 85 Hawk mission in his office. The finding Reagan signed right after it went sideways. The finding that was never delivered to Congress. Poindexter knows that document is an embarrassment to the president. And even more, he knows it's a serious legal liability. So Poindexter takes the finding in his hands and tears it to pieces. Poindexter and Ed Meese meet with President Reagan in the White House later that day. Chief of Staff Don Regan joins them. Ed believes that if Reagan knew about the 85 Hawk shipment, and if he authorized it, and if he didn't inform Congress, then the president is in serious jeopardy. Ed tells Reagan that he wants to nail down the facts and put together a complete version of the truth. He asks Reagan to give him the weekend to sort it out. Reagan agrees and officially orders Ed to launch a fact-finding mission. The real purpose of Ed's expedition is subject to debate. It's either an honest attempt to help President Reagan understand the truth, or it's an attempt to cover it up while making it look like no stone was left unturned. On Saturday morning, the day after his meeting with Reagan, Ed sits down with Secretary of State George Shultz. Shultz tells Ed the president admitted knowing about the November 85 Hawk shipment, but Ed already knows that. He attended a meeting earlier in the month where the Hawk shipments were discussed. The two Israeli shipments that predated the Hawk shipments were also discussed. Ed is a meticulous note taker. Over the weekend, Ed calls Don Regan on the phone multiple times to talk about what he knows. But curiously, Ed does not take notes during those calls. In fact, he doesn't keep any record of his talks with Don. When asked later about the content of these conversations, Ed will say he does not recall. Don will say he doesn't recall either. A lot of people don't recall. Next, Ed talks to Don's nemesis, Bud McFarlane. Bud tells Ed that although he doesn't have proof in writing, there's no doubt in his mind, President Reagan definitely knew about the 1985 Hawk shipment. While Ed is questioning Reagan's cabinet, his deputies at the Justice Department start digging through NSC records. There's a mountain of paperwork, internal communications, memos, and routine filings. For the most part, it's typical bureaucratic red tape. But when they make their way to the records from Ollie North's office, they find something explosive. When Ed Meese starts his internal fact-finding investigation, the Iran operation is public knowledge, but the diversion is not. And the connection to Nicaragua is still under wraps. Throughout 1985 and 86, there are rumors in the press about the Contra operation. There are even rumors that Ollie North is the one pulling the strings, but there was never a smoking gun. In October 1986, when Eugene Hasenfuss's plane crashed into the Nicaraguan jungle, those rumors reached a fever pitch, but repeated denials from the Reagan administration satisfied Congress and reduced the heat from the press. And when the Al-Shaarah story broke, the media's attention shifted away from Nicaragua completely. No one knew the two stories were linked, but Ollie did. So when Ed starts his fact-finding expedition, Ollie knows he's in hot water. Ollie also knows it's only a matter of time before lawyers from the Department of Justice search his office. And if the paper trail for Iran-Contra is discovered, it could be a serious problem for President Reagan, and for Ollie, too. On November 21st, Ollie North fires up his government-issue industrial-strength paper shredder and starts destroying documents. He doesn't do it alone. He has the help of his personal secretary, a fiercely loyal woman from Virginia named Fawn Hall. It's November 21st, 1986. For Fawn Hall, the day starts like any other. She drives to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, makes her way through security, and walks downstairs to the basement of the White House. She makes a pot of coffee, pours herself a cup, and heads to her desk. Fawn's come a long way from her hometown of Annandale, Virginia. Annandale's only about a half hour southwest of D.C., but for a southern gal from pretty much nowhere, the office of the National Security Council is a big deal. That Friday morning, her boss bursts into the room.
Fawn! Yes, sir? I need your help.
Normally, Colonel North is a pretty happy-go-lucky guy. Today, though, something's different. Fawn knows right away that whatever's going on, it is serious.
What do you need, Colonel? I've marked up these documents.
Okay.
I need you to make some alterations.
The colonel's stricken through several sentences on each page, and he's scribbled some handwritten notes in the margins. From what Fawn can see, there's something about $20 million from Saudi Arabia, and something about a Nicaraguan merchant ship. But Fawn doesn't know what any of it means.
Can you make these alterations for me, Fawn? This is top priority.
The question gives her pause. She may not understand the context of the papers, but she knows this much. Altering official documents is not part of her job description. It might even be illegal. But Colonel North is a good man. He's been a good boss. He wouldn't be asking if it weren't important.
I'll get right on it, sir. File the new ones and bring the originals to my office straight away.
And then he starts to go.
Colonel, wait. I think there's something wrong with this document.
What do you mean wrong?
There's a box at the bottom of the first page. It looks like it's meant to show Mr. McFarland's approval.
Yeah, what about it?
But it's not checked on the original. Should I add a check mark?
Yes. Thank you, Fawn.
Yes, sir.
With that, he's gone. Fawn slides in front of the keyboard, types up the new memos, and files them away. She heads to the colonel's office to give him the originals, but when she opens the door, he's not there. So she leaves the original memos sitting on his desk and closes the door behind her.
Fawn!
She turns to find Colonel North standing outside his office near the paper shredder, a stack of documents 2 feet tall in his hands.
Can you help me with these two?
Fawn doesn't give it a second thought. She doesn't ask questions. If Colonel North needs her help, that's her job. She grabs a document from the stack and shoves it in the shredder. And then another, and another, and another, until the whole stack disappears. Whether Fawn knows it or not, her boss just committed several felonies, and so did she. Fawn will later say that the infamous shredding party on November 21st was no big deal, but that's not true. It was a big deal, and it will come back to haunt them both. Together, Fawn and Ollie destroyed 15 months worth of private messages between Ollie and members of his staff. No one will ever know the true content of those documents, except for Ollie and Fawn. Over the weekend, Ollie sits down for his interview with Ed Meese. Ed grills him about the Iran operation, but Ollie plays it cool. He's not worried, and why should he be? If the president knew about this mission, if he authorized it, then Ollie has nothing to fear. Besides, Ed does not know Ollie has altered documents. He doesn't know about the thousands of pages Ollie and Fawn shoved into the shredder on November 21st. Ollie has covered his tracks. Except, Ollie neglected to destroy one document, which Ed Meese's lawyers found when they searched Ollie's office the day before. A document proving conclusively that profits from the arms for hostages deal were funneled to the Contras in Nicaragua. A document that will come to be known as the Diversion Memo.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
On November 24th, 1986, Don Regan sits down for a meeting in the Situation Room with President Reagan and the top members of the National Security Planning Group. Normally, aides and other senior officials are present for the NSPG meetings. But today, the chairs lining the walls are empty. Today, it's just the top dogs. That's because today's topic is especially sensitive. It's about more than national security. It's fraught with political and legal implications, which is why there's a special guest in the room. Attorney General Ed Meese. The cabinet is still at odds over what really happened and what the president knew. And Reagan is starting to lose his composure. He pounds his fist on the table and roars, "I did not trade arms for hostages." Ed Meese is the only one in the room who has spoken to all the players in an official capacity. Don Regan turns to him and asks the million-dollar question, "Did the president approve the 1985 Hawk transaction?" Everyone in the room already knows the answer. Ed Meese knows. Don Regan and George Shultz know. Reagan admitted it to them both a few days earlier. "Oh, I knew about that, but that wasn't arms for hostages." But the question posed, did Reagan know about the 85 Hawk missile deal, isn't the question needing an answer. The real question is, who is going to take the blame for this? Finally, Poindexter speaks up with a bold claim. Bud handled the Israel-Iran sales alone. Ed agrees. The Hawk shipment was illegal, there's no doubt, but the president didn't know anything about it because Bud did not tell him. It's a lie. Everyone in the room knows it, but no one pushes back. No one says a word. It's significant to note that in the meeting on November 24th, Ed Meese doesn't mention the diversion memo. Neither does Don Regan. Maybe that's because the diversion is just the thing Don and Ed need to protect the president. A cohesive narrative that will point the finger of blame somewhere else. But Don knows that Bud McFarlane's head on a silver platter is not enough. Bud has already resigned. He's a private citizen now. Don needs someone in office in the Reagan administration to lay the blame on. So Don takes the scheme one step further. After the meeting on November 24th, Don circulates a private memo titled Plan of Action. He writes, "Tough as it seems, blame must be put at NSC's door. Rogue operations going on without president's knowledge or consent." In the memo, Regan calls for the resignation of National Security Advisor John Poindexter and the ousting of Oliver North. After reading Don's memo, Poindexter gets a panic call from one of Ollie's subordinates. "Are you resigning?" Poindexter doesn't answer. The caller pushes back. "Stay at your post, Admiral. Force the president to step up to the plate and take responsibility for his actions." But Poindexter knows it's over. He's been flanked by Don Regan and Ed Meese. He responds, "It's too late. They're building a wall around him." On November 25th, Regan calls a press conference to announce the result of the Attorney General's investigation.
"Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Last Friday, after becoming concerned whether my national security apparatus had provided me with a security or a complete factual record with respect to the implementation of my policy toward Iran, I directed the Attorney General to undertake a review of this matter over the weekend and report to me on Monday. And yesterday, Secretary Meese provided me and the White House Chief of Staff with a report on his preliminary findings. And this report led me to conclude that I was not fully informed on the nature of one of the activities undertaken in connection with this initiative. This action raises serious questions of propriety. I've just met with my national security advisors and congressional leaders to inform them of the actions that I'm taking today. Although not directly involved, Vice Admiral John Poindexter has asked to be relieved of his assignment as Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs and to return to another assignment in the Navy. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North has been relieved of his duties on the National Security Council staff. And now I'm going to ask Attorney General Meese to briefly...
Reagan tries to quickly wrap it up, but the press has questions they won't
hold
answer.
It.
Did you make a mistake in sending arms to Tehran, sir?
No, and I'm not taking any more questions. In just a second, I'm going to ask Attorney General Meese to brief you on what we presently know of what he has found out.
Is anyone else going to be let go, sir? Is anyone else going to be let go?
Secretary Schultz.
No one was let go. They chose to go.
What about Secretary Schultz, Mr. President?
What about Secretary Schultz, sir?
Can you give Secretary Schultz a vote of confidence?
Ed Meese quickly takes the podium as Reagan exits to a barrage of questions. When the press is quieted, he drops a massive bomb. The issue Reagan wasn't fully informed of.
Why don't I tell you what is the situation, and then I'll take your questions. What is involved is that in the course of the arms transfers, which involved the United States providing the arms to Israel, and Israel in turn transferring the arms, in effect selling the arms, to representatives of Iran, certain monies which were received in the transaction between representatives of Israel and representatives of Iran were taken and made available to the forces in Central America which are opposing the Sandinista government there.
There's an audible gasp in the room. This is the moment the American people learn for the first time that two separate scandals in two separate countries on opposite sides of the globe are actually one. The moment when the world learns that money from the Iran deal was funneled to fund the Contras in Nicaragua. Ed goes on to say the president knew nothing about the diversion and that the White House will be launching a full-scale internal investigation into the matter. Ollie will later write that the Reagan administration chose to focus almost exclusively on the diversion, and there was certainly a lot to be gained in presenting it that way. This particular detail was so dramatic, so sexy, that it might actually, well, divert attention from other, even more important aspects of the story, such as what else the president and his top advisors had known about and approved. Ollie isn't the only one who feels this way. A reporter at the November 25th press conference asks Ed Meese, what's to prevent an increasingly cynical public from thinking that you went looking for a scapegoat and came up with this whopper, even though it doesn't have a lot to do with the original controversy? Ed is evasive. The president's priority is to lay out the facts just as rapidly as he gets them, to be sure that there is no hint that anything is trying to be concealed. The reporter's question about scapegoating is a perceptive one, and the reporter won't be the last to ask that type of question. Meanwhile, as Fawn Hall watches the press conference from North's office, she's terrified, because Fawn realizes she's made a terrible mistake. Some of the original memos, the ones she altered at the colonel's behest, were never destroyed. It's unclear why she didn't destroy them. Maybe she didn't think she needed to. Or maybe, in the chaos of the shredding party, she simply forgot. But after the official announcement that her boss has been fired and Meese's revelation about the diversion, Fawn Hall is starting to grasp just how much trouble she and Colonel North might be in. So on November 25th, she stuffs the original memos into her blouse, sneaks them past NSC officials who are sealing off the office, and delivers them personally to Colonel North. There's another important person watching the press conference on November 25th. His name is Lawrence Walsh. Walsh is a lifelong Republican, a former deputy attorney general, and a former prosecutor for the Southern District of New York. But in his 70s now, Walsh's day of public service are far behind him. That day, he watches Reagan's press conference from his home in Oklahoma City. A reporter asks Ed Meese another question, will Ed consider appointing a special prosecutor to look into the matter? Ed, as always, is calculated and measured in his response. He says he wants to wait for the facts. At the moment, though, he sees no need for outside help. But on December 6, 1986, a little more than a week after that press conference, Ed Meese will get outside help. Lawrence Walsh receives a phone call from a federal judge offering him a job. Not long after, he'll pack his bags, fly to D.C., and launch one of the most controversial investigations in American political history. On the first Sunday of 1987, Walsh, the newly appointed independent counsel for the Iran-Contra investigation, begins his journey by checking into the infamous Watergate Hotel. From Wondery, this is episode 3 of 6 of Iran-Contra for American Scandal. On the next episode, independent prosecutor Lawrence Walsh is called to D.C. to find out the truth. He expects a tough fight with the Reagan administration, but his first opponent is the United States Congress. If you'd like to learn more about Iran-Contra, we recommend the books Firewall by Lawrence Walsh, Under Fire by Oliver North, and Special Trust by Bud McFarlane. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details, and while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Scandal is hosted, edited, sound designed, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Additional production assistance by Derek Behrens. This episode is written by Stephen Walters, edited by Andrew Stelzer. Our consultant is Malcolm Byrne. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marsha Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.